From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, a subterranean river of chauvinism. That is what a special investigation in The Atlantic points to as one of the reasons why rape may be one of the easiest crimes to get away with. Thousands of untested rape kits, detectives closing cases because they just don't believe the victims, or they say the victims should have taken better care of themselves. Serial rapists who walk free because of those law enforcement decisions. However, some cities are trying to change that. They're testing the backlog of rape kits, revealing the patterns of sexual predators, and challenging the culture of disbelief. How are they doing it, and will more jurisdictions follow? This hour on Point, why police don't catch serial rapists. And you can join us. How has the backlog of rape kit had an impact on your life? Are you a victim of a sexual predator and waiting for justice? And if you're in law enforcement, how are police officers and prosecutors handling what The Atlantic calls this subterranean river of chauvinism that's preventing perhaps justice being served in many cases of rape and sexual assault? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's a contributing writer for The Atlantic. She spent a year investigating the national backlog of untested rape kits, as well as the implications of that backlog. We have an excerpt of her article in The Atlantic that is linked to onpointradio.org. And of course, for longtime NPR listeners, Barbara's voice will be very familiar because she was a correspondent for NPR for nearly two decades. So Barbara Bradley Haggerty, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to On Point. Welcome to the show.
Great. It's so great to be here. Thank you, Meghna.
I'm having one of those moments where I'm just a huge fan of yours as well for having listened to you on NPR for so long. So,
and back at you.
But let's get right to this incredible investigation that you've published here in The Atlantic. And I'd actually like to start with a story. And it's one that you tell early in the piece about a serial rapist called Eric Eugene Wilkes, and how he was known to Detroit police for other crimes, but how somehow, for years, he got away with multiple sexual assaults. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. So he was known for carjacking in Detroit and robbery and other kind of minor crimes. The police didn't really think that he was a rapist. They didn't have any idea that he was a rapist. But on December 26th of 2000, he raped a woman who was waiting for a bus. And the police, she got a rape exam, they got a rape kit. The police did not send the rape kit into the lab. They just shelved it. And so, 4 months later, Eric Wilkes raped another woman. 3 days later, he raped another woman. Those rape kits just went into storage in a warehouse in Detroit. He raped again and again and again over the next 11 years, and police just kept putting those kits, not knowing that they held in their hands the biological fingerprint of a serial rapist. They just put those boxes on the shelf. Finally, after his 11th victim, he was identified by her. They arrested him, and then years later, when they tested all of those, get this, 11,341 rape kits that were put in storage in Detroit. When they began testing them, they found that his DNA matched 11 people. So it was kind of a cautionary tale. I mean, the Detroit warehouse, which was this really decrepit warehouse where the windows were broken and, you know, birds were flying around. This became a symbol of neglect and how police really didn't take seriously women's allegations of rape.
So in the Wilkes case, 11 years, 11 violent rapes, and the implication being that if that first rape kit had been tested, that potentially 10 other women would have possibly been spared.
Yeah, that is really one of the big through lines. I mean, one of the tragic things about this is the time that women are raped is literally the worst moment of their lives, right? Imagine if police had taken that first victim seriously, or even the second victim seriously, tested the kit, did a thorough investigation, caught that rapist. That would have saved 9, 10, 8, some amount of number of women the worst moments of their lives. It would have spared them. And this is happening across the country, that a lot of rapists are serial rapists, a surprising number. And so if police would take them seriously, the women seriously at the beginning, a lot of women's lives would not be changed in a terrible way for the rest of their lives.
So I definitely want to talk to you in detail about what you've uncovered about attitudes in law enforcement. But let's stay with this notion of what the testing of these rape kits finally is beginning to reveal. I mean, how many of these crimes are being perpetrated by serial rapists?
Well, it's really very interesting. Cleveland has been kind of a city on the hill, and they've actually given all of the information about their 7,000 untested rape kits. They're now tested to Case Western Reserve University. So they've been able, the researchers there have been able to look and see, gosh, let's look at this information. Oh, my goodness, one out of five of these rape kits ping to a serial rapist. I've seen higher figures, like in Detroit, I've seen it's like 38% ping to serial rapists. So what that means is that there are a lot more serial rapists out there than anyone would suspect. I think in Cleveland, they have realized that they have had at some point 400 serial rapists in a mid-sized town. Can you imagine what it would be like in New York or Los Angeles? So it's really a pretty stunning statistic. It's a pretty scary statistic, but there's hope in it. If the police take it seriously, they will be able to stop these rapists and spare a lot of women's lives.
So as you write in your article in The Atlantic, that this scandal about untested rape kits, which has been going on for several years, I mean, hundreds of thousands of rape kits not tested across the country, that it's one of the most visible aspects of the deeper problem of law enforcement just not believing women. But tell me, I mean, I think it still may come as a surprise or a shock to people that rape kits just aren't automatically tested as soon as they're collected. I mean, what is the process there? Who makes the decision about whether to shelve it or not?
Well, it appears, I mean, I'm sure it varies from city to city and state to state, but it appears that it's pretty much a police decision whether to send that into the lab or not. And some cities have really gotten serious about it. The federal government is now offering money, millions of dollars, to cities and states to go ahead and send in their kits to the lab so that they will be tested. But it seems to be, according to the researchers I talked to, more of a police issue than certainly a prosecutor issue. And so somewhere along the line, someone decides not to send these kits in. And you know, I want to talk a little bit, if I may, about what the surprising thing about this. I mean, we've known about these untested rape kits for a little while. It's been a scandal for a while. But the question I wanted to get at is why? I mean, this is a great piece of evidence, right? The DNA, the biological fingerprint of a perpetrator may easily be in that rape kit. You could know the name of the guy. So why aren't you testing it? And you alluded to this in your intro, which is there is this kind of reflexive disbelief of women. And what I found and researchers have found is that if a so-called righteous victim comes to the police. That is, if a woman who was raped by a stranger, who fought back, you know, who was clean of drugs or alcohol, if a so-called righteous victim came to the police, they would be very excited about pursuing that case. Only one out of five women is raped by a stranger. So that cuts out, you know, 60% or 80% of the cases right there. But if the victim knows the assailant, if it's a so-called acquaintance rape, then the case was often closed pretty quickly. So police detectives talked about party rapes where the victim, you know, was drinking and taking drugs or whatever, and she with the perpetrator, and she, quote, got what she got. They talked about buyer's remorse, where a woman woke up and kind of regretted the sex. They talked about revenge rape, where, you know, this was often used in the case of prostitutes, where, you know, they were mad about non-payment. So this was a kind of skeptical language that we saw in police reports. And sometimes, and you alluded to this, sometimes detectives thought that the victims just made it up. And you mentioned this 14-year-old girl. There was a 14-year-old girl in Detroit who reported that two men dragged her into an abandoned house and raped her. And this is what the police report says. This heifer is tripping. She was clean and smelling good. Ain't no way that blank happened like she said. The jig was up. She didn't want to talk no more. So her mama took her to the hospital, and they got the blank out of here. It was a two-page report, and it ends this way. This case is closed. UTEEC. Unable to establish the elements of the crime.
That
My jaw dropped.
That is written into a police report.
That's in a police report, a two-page report. They weren't able to establish the elements of the crime.
And the part that really just stopped me when I read that repeatedly was the this heifer's trippin', quote
right.
unquote, because this young girl was clean and smelling good, that it wasn't possible for a crime to have been committed against her. That's what it seems like the law enforcement officer was asserting.
Right. And, you know, what we have to understand is that most rapes don't happen to, you know, suburban women picking up their kid, waiting the carpool, you know, or driving the carpool, waiting for their kids to come from school or even walking home from the metro station. Most rapes happen to vulnerable people in poorer areas, in poorer neighborhoods, people who are just less advantaged. And so the police tend to look at them much more skeptically, and they tend to ascribe, you know, they tend to look at the victim and judge the victim and decide whether it's worthy of pursuing a case. They don't look at the act itself. I mean, I'm making blanket statements here. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great detectives out there, okay? And you're going to talk to Rick Bell, who's a terrific prosecutor. So there are a lot of great people out there. But often what they do is they judge the victim by her appearance or her socioeconomic standing. And then they decide whether or not the case is worthy to be pursued.
Right. Well, Barbara, as you said, in a little while, we will talk to Chief Rick Bell from Cleveland, Ohio, about the different take they're taking in Cleveland, a city on a hill, as you called it, regarding this issue. So we will do that. But we are talking this hour with Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's a contributing writer at The Atlantic, and she's written a year-long investigation into why law enforcement has difficulty catching serial rapists. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about why police don't catch serial rapists and the cities that are working hard to change that. And this discussion is based on a terrific year-long investigation that has been recently published in The Atlantic. It was done by Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's a contributing writer to The Atlantic, and we have a link to her article at onpointradio.org. And before the break, Barbara was talking about this attitude amongst many, some members of law enforcement about quote-unquote righteous victims and how perhaps they are the ones worthy of further investigation and even charges or seeking of justice when they have been attacked by a sexual predator. And on that point, I just want to play a little bit of tape because here's Kim Worthy. She is the prosecutor in Wayne County, Michigan. And in 2009, a member of her office discovered more than 11,000 untested rape kits in a warehouse. Barbara had mentioned that before. It was a really big moment in Detroit. And so here's Prosecutor Worthy talking about the reasons that so many rape cases in Detroit had gone unsolved.
There was perpetual victim blaming when these victims came to report their crimes. That's the rape culture. And because of this victim blaming of someone that had been violently assaulted, some of these victims were even ridiculed into not continuing to proceed with their case.
That's Kim Worthy, prosecutor in Wayne County, Michigan. Now, Barbara, your reporting is filled with so many examples. I would love to hear another one about this issue of victim blaming. You sat down with Amber Mansfield, I believe. She's in Minnesota. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. I did. Amber Mansfield. She, Amber, this was a really, really interesting case. Amber was in 2015. Amber Mansfield started hanging out with a childhood friend named Keith Washington. He had just been released in May of 2015 from prison. He told her he was in prison for assaulting a police officer. It turned out he was actually in there for a violent rape. But one day in July of 2015, kind of went on a rampage. He got irate. He choked her until she passed out. And when she came to a couple of hours later, he raped her. Okay, so she goes to the police. She gets a rape kit. She goes to the police. And the police look at her very, very skeptically. And here's why. Amber had had a checkered past. She was raised in foster homes. She had a misdemeanor prostitution charge when she was in her early 20s. But now she was in her late 30s. She had completely cleaned up. She had moved out of Minneapolis to a little town. She had a daughter at this point. The daughter was 5 years old, you know, an SUV, a house. You know, she was doing well. She was doing really well. So she goes to the police. She tells them about this, and the police just look at her skeptically. She figured that they would look at both her past record and Keith Washington's past record. And she was half right. They looked at her record. They didn't bother to look at his record. And what was incredible was that they dredged up this 14-year-old case of misdemeanor prostitution charge and decided that, you know, she was a prostitute and that they weren't going to do anything about it. And I talked to the detective there, the head of the sex crimes unit, who's now retired. His name is Mike Sorrow. And he basically said, look, you know, if you're not going to take care of yourself, why should I? I looked at her past and I said, to hell with this. We're not going to do anything about this. I'm not going to waste my time with this.
Can I just jump in here, Barbara? Yeah. Because I have the quote from him in your piece directly in front of me. I think it's just worth reading in its entirety.
Sure.
First of all, I'm impressed that he sat down with you because clearly, I mean, he's retired. Now, but you mentioned a little later, he's a dedicated law enforcement officer.
Yes.
He was very frustrated every time a perpetrator slipped through the cracks. He wants to catch criminals. But at the same time, here's what he told you. He said, after he looked, after he saw Mansfield's background check, he said, quote, I'm thinking, whoa, wait a second here. How much resources am I going to spend if you're that, how should I say, careless with your own self? We're not going to spend any time on this. I mean,
I know. I was a little surprised he said that to me as well. But you know, you get when they have as many cases as they do, they just start to kind of triage. And so they just thought, well, we're not going to bother with this case. And so what happened, I mean, let me just mention that if he or anyone else had spent 20 minutes typing in Keith Washington's name into the system, the national or statewide database, they would have found that he was a level 3 sex offender. That is the most violent and most likely to offend. They didn't look at that. They didn't find that out. And so what happened, inevitably, is that a few months later, Keith Washington accosted two women within the space of a couple of hours, left them unconscious and partially dressed, and they picked him up. It's Amber Mansfield's view that those assaults didn't need to happen. But because they didn't believe her, because they didn't bother to check on his background, a serial rapist was allowed to go free. Mm.
Well, let's go to the calls, Barbara, if we may, because there are a lot of them. Katrin is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Katrin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I read the article yesterday and was really struck by a lot of the details, but I think the thing that struck me the most was that 1 in 5 appear to be serial rapists. And I was raped in 2005 in New York City, and my experience really fits the story quite well. The cops told my boyfriend when I went to the hospital to get the rape kit done that sometimes girlfriends lie because they don't want to be found to have cheated. The doctor in the emergency department was annoyed and said he didn't want to do another rape kit. And then the DA said that they weren't going to prosecute because there wasn't enough evidence. And when I spoke with a lawyer, he said, unfortunately, rape is essentially legal in this country. Yeah, and that just kind of reconfirms what you're talking about. But reading the article actually made me want to investigate whether my rape kit was tested. Because even though it's probably past the statute of limitations for any kind of prosecution, what I'm curious about is, the story is very detailed and I won't go into it, but I get the feeling from this guy that he has done this before, and he's a quite powerful individual in New York City. And I wonder if there were other DNA kits, would they reveal that he's also a serial rapist? Probably.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that is a fascinating. I'm so sorry about that. That is, it's. I'm sure it was the worst moments of your life. You know, New York City actually has been pretty good about testing its backlog. They had 17,000 kits that were untested, and they went ahead and started testing them. I think they've tested all of them. I would bet you anything that if you inquired, you could find out whether your assailant has also assaulted other people. I would bet you anything, because I think they've tested virtually all of those kits.
And Barbara,
the statute of limitations isn't very good. Right.
Sorry, Barbara, how would she go about making that inquiry? I mean,
well, I would call the sex crimes unit in the New York Police, you know, New York Police Department, and I would start there and just tell them your story. And I think they'd be able to find that out. They'd at least tell you how you could find it out. That's what I would do.
Okay. Well, Katrin, thank you so much for your call. Now, Barbara, in a moment here, I am going to turn to Chief Rick Bell from Cleveland, Ohio. But can you first tell us, there are certain jurisdictions, Cleveland being amongst them, perhaps chief amongst them, that have tried really hard to deal with this problem, not just of the rape kit backlog, but of unearthing the information that all those kits could reveal. So what is it that Cleveland and Cuyahoga County have done that's so remarkably different?
Well, they really are the great example of how you handle this well, because not only have they gone ahead, they had the will to test the kits, but they also then, once they got the results, began to investigate very, very quickly, indict people, and they have by far the most number of people, perpetrators, who have been indicted and convicted. And they're a mid-sized city, so they had the will to do this. But let me tell you this other thing they did that is so helpful. They gave all the information, as I mentioned, to Case Western Reserve University. And what Case Western was able to do was begin to see the patterns, the unexpected patterns of rapists. And they found several things. One is there are a lot more serial rapists than you would ever think. But they also found, and this was extremely interesting for law enforcement, they also found that people who rape strangers often rape acquaintances as well. Mm. So it was long thought that, okay, you know, if an acquaintance is raped, we don't need to test that kit because we know who the suspect is, right? So no reason to send that kit into the lab. But what Cleveland found is that when they sent all of their kits to the lab, they found that these acquaintance rapes were the DNA from the acquaintance rapes were pinging into stranger rapes. Uh-huh. So suddenly they were solving rapes, cold cases where they had no suspects. Suddenly they had a name and an identification of that stranger rapist. And so there's just really kind of interesting. There's so much that can be done with this DNA information. And Cleveland is really leading the way in what should be done.
Right. I mean, we should know that their efforts have been quite extensive, right? As you write, in 2013, Tim McGinty, who at that time had just been elected Cuyahoga County prosecutor, he created a special task force. I think he brought in some retired detectives to help deal with these new investigations. And he, in fact, allowed reporters to repeatedly attend weekly meetings of this special investigative unit. So a real commitment there. But but you also note that all of this happened after a terrible scandal of a serial killer and a rapist who had the bodies of 11 women had been discovered in his backyard. So
yeah, the case of Anthony Sowell, and basically that caused this real soul searching among law enforcement in Cleveland. You know, why didn't we believe women who escaped from Sowell and told us about him? Why didn't we believe him? Why aren't we testing kits? How many kits are there after all? Oh my goodness, there are, you know, like 7,000 stored kits. So it caused a real soul searching. It was kind of like finding all of those rape kits in that warehouse in Detroit. There was a moment moment where they stopped and said, you know what, we've got to do something about this. Yeah. And Cleveland and Detroit did.
Well, let's talk to one of the people who's actually doing this work. So Chief Rick Bell joins us now from Cleveland, Ohio. He's the Special Investigations Chief for the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office and a member of the Cuyahoga County Sexual Assault Kit Task Force. Chief Bell, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Megan.
So first of all, Chief, can you tell us a little bit about the prior to 2013, the attitudes that may have been pervasive in Cuyahoga County law enforcement that allowed so many kits, for example, to go untested? As Barbara had been saying earlier, perhaps there was a culture of disbelief in addressing victims when they came forward. Was that a problem in Cuyahoga County?
Well, it's a fair question. There's a lot going on that kind of happened when all of these rape kits weren't tested. Part of it, you could say that there was an old police culture that doesn't exist now, that kits didn't need to be tested. And part of it was perhaps an unbelief or a shutting down of some of the cases. That doesn't seem to be the case now. The culture seems to have been changed because of all of the attention that we've brought to all of these kits and all of the work that's been done by the team here, 40 people, good people, as you said, started by Tim McGinney, but Prosecutor Michael O'Malley is fervent in the belief that each and every single kit needs to be tested and investigated, and that's the key. That's the key, that you have to have the willpower from somebody in each city, whether it be the prosecutor or whether it be the mayor, that every kit needs to be investigated, not only tested, but investigated all the way. And that means talking to the victims and using advocates and a full team like we have.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about what it's taken to bring so many of these cases to a much more just form of conclusion, because you must have been running up against statutes of limitations on some of these cases. How'd you handle that?
We were, and Barbara appropriately reported about that. Many of our cases were about to run out of their 20-year statute of limitations, and we had all hands on deck. We reddened those cases, and if a case was about to be dismissed or never be able to be brought, we needed to make sure that all of our investigators were working it. And sometimes we would go into the grand jury at 4:15 in the afternoon, and the grand jury session would close at 4:30. But we needed to do what we needed to do early on to make sure that we didn't lose a single case.
And so Barbara said that Cleveland has been Cuyahoga County has been very successful in these efforts. I mean, how do you measure what the success has been?
Well, I think the best way to measure is case by case when you're talking to the victims, the appreciation that our advocates and our investigators are receiving from people as you knock on the doors, as you talk to them and they say, where have you been? Or I wish the police had done a better job back then. And thank you, Cold Case Unit, for talking to me now. We could spread across numbers that are enormous, 748 defendants indicted, and of those already convicted, 472, but and there's 824 serial rapists that you talked about. Mm-hmm. But really, the story is in those individual accounts from our survivors that are just so appreciative that their rapist has been caught and that somebody won't be raped again because we're following through now.
So, Barbara, let me turn back to you. How does, for example, the number of convictions that Cuyahoga County has brought forward or concluded, how does that compare to other cities that are trying to deal with their rape kit backlog?
Oh, it's stunningly high. Okay, it's stunningly high. I mean, let me just mention something. It's called SAKI, the mm-hmm. Sexual Assault Kit Initiative. And this is the initiative where the federal government, since 2015, has given out about $154 million to various cities and states so that they will go ahead and test their kits. So I it's a great idea, right? You know, you test a kit, you catch a rapist, you prevent future rapes. It's a great idea. The Obama administration started it. So I wondered, okay, how are these guys doing? How are these, in this case, 41 sites that have been that received money in 2015, 16, and 17, which were the latest numbers I could get? It turns out, you know, hey, they've done launched 5,500 investigations. They've got 500 pleas or convictions. That's the good news. The bad news is, of those 41 sites, two of them, Cleveland and Detroit, scored almost all of the successes, right? Like 38% of the investigations, two-thirds of all the new charges, 82% of the convictions were brought by prosecutors and in Detroit and in Cleveland. So what we see here is there's a will, there's giving away money, but we haven't seen these sites move as quickly as, for example, Cleveland has, which suggests that there may not be the will. Now Rick's going to jump in here and say, that's not fair. That's not fair. It takes a long time. And that's true. But Rick, you know what? It took you guys, 10 months sometimes to go from the time you sent a kit into the lab to the time of indictment. Mm. So you guys were really, really fast.
Well, Barbara, hang on here for just a second, because I'm going to give Chief Bell a chance to respond to that. But in about a minute and a half, when we come back from a break. So this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about why it's so hard for police to catch serial rapists. And our conversation is based on a year-long investigation that was just published in The Atlantic magazine. The investigation was done by Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's a contributing writer for The Atlantic. And we have a link to her article at onpointradio.org. Chief Rick Bell also joins us today. He's with us from Cleveland. He is the Special Investigations Chief for the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office and a member of the Cuyahoga County Sexual Assault Kit Task Force. Now, Chief Bell, just before the break, as you heard, Barbara was pointing out that Cuyahoga County ramped up its efforts to deal with this problem rather quickly. And what's your response to that in terms of not seeing that same effort or that same quick ramping up in other cities?
Well, I guess we take a lot of pride in what we do. I'm a prosecutor. We like putting away the bad guys. I have to imagine that everybody else that's in this position across the country would love to do the same thing. We're in our very unique position here because we have a lot of resources that have been given to us. We would not have been able to do this without the Department of Justice or our Attorney General, who's now our governor, Mike DeWine. And without the testing in-house at the laboratory, without being able to pick up the phone and say, could you do a little more testing for us, without our investigators and advocates being right here, co-located with us and embedded with us, I'm not sure that this would have been successful. But I think you have to get back, in fairness to everybody, to that question or that point that you and Barbara made before, and that's the willpower to do this. Mm. Yeah, somebody has to take on the effort. Somebody has to make sure that they're investigating these cases all the way through, not just doing the testing. And I think that we probably did have a head start. And I guess I can talk about what we've done, and I can see that it's happening across the country. I'm more concerned about those cities that haven't done an inventory, mm-hmm. that haven't even started or attempted, that haven't the willpower to even look at it and say, is there a culture change we need to make?
Yeah. So, Chief,
and that's
can I just
what we
yeah.
need to talk about.
Yeah, let me just jump in here because I think you're making a very important point. In Cuyahoga County, you had the combination of willpower and funds, as you said. Barbara, in her reporting, points out that there are other cities that have funds that have not, or federal funds, and have not come up with the same kind of results as you have. But to this point of willpower, what you're saying is that someone in a position of influence or someones have to care. And if we're talking about a pervasive culture of not believing victims or not finding these cases worthy of more investigation, how do we change that? How do we get law enforcement officials, prosecutors, DAs, governors, as you're saying, to care?
It's you have to think about the victims that you're meeting. I'll just take it back to, I have 7 sisters and 3 daughters that are watching over everything that I do. Do I think for a second that I would get away with not caring for someone? They would be on me. And I think you have to take it down to that question. What if this were my daughter? What if this were my sister? What do I need to do to treat them fairly and righteously, and to do everything in my power to do that? And I think that people want to do the right thing, but so oftentimes the bureaucracies in different departments kind of fight against that, and especially the volume. The volume of cases is just undaunting for a detective in any department that doesn't have the resources.
Barbara, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but I have one more question for the chief, because I absolutely hear you when you say, you know, when you look into the eyes of a victim that comes in and wants to report a crime, like you might see your daughter or someone you love. But isn't the problem that, according to Barbara's reporting, what a lot of law enforcement officials are seeing isn't that kind of they're not having that response of empathy, but rather they're seeing, oh, here's a woman who once was convicted of prostitution, or here's a 14-year-old who might be lying, or here's a woman who maybe chose a bad relationship. I mean, they're not seeing someone that they care about. They're seeing something else entirely.
Well, then what you do is you talk to them about turning their focus to the bad guy, which is what we in law enforcement, prosecutors and detectives, like to do. And it really should be judgmentalness against him. Now that we know that rapists will rape again and again, mm-hmm. and now that we know that they'll also commit other crimes. Mm-hmm. Case Western Reserve pointed out that one of our rapists will actually commit, 70% of the time, will commit another crime, mm-hmm. domestic violence, burglary, robbery, you name it. So once you have the opportunity to put a sexual offender in jail, you're preventing other crimes from taking place. You need to get into his mindset and why he did what he did. And once you understand that this person is likely to commit another crime or has already committed a crime, and you can put a pattern together, then you can actually do your job. And now that we can follow the science, you can actually throw that kit into the mail right away, get it submitted, get it tested, get it back quickly. Now there's really no excuse on any case to not investigate it thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, I know you want to jump in here, so go ahead.
Well, no, I agree with everything that he says. It's kind of a no-brainer to go ahead and take these women seriously. As one advocate said, it shouldn't be he said, she said. It should be she said. Let's believe her and let's investigate. And, well, you know, we aren't going to – police should not be lightly putting a man's reputation in jeopardy by, you know, kind of doing these investigations and charging them when there's not the evidence. But let's just assume that she's telling the truth. For one thing, I mean, to get to the point where a woman is sitting in front of a police officer, she has to have – you know, gone to the hospital, gotten this really intrusive rape exam where they swab and pluck every part of her body. It's humiliating. It's painful. It's traumatic. And then to go, and then they show up at the police station. These people should be taken seriously. These are not people who are doing this on a whim. And so I think the first step is to say, okay, the fact that she's sitting right here is really significant, and we need to investigate that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been making our callers wait for quite some time, so let me just bring them back into the conversation here. Thea is calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So in 2016, 2017, I worked as a domestic violence advocate in Detroit, Michigan. I was placed embedded in a precinct, and I sat with the detectives who investigated various crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault. And it was a really painful experience because probably 8 hours a day, I listened to the detectives constantly victim blaming to the point that there was a call into the precinct, and this woman was saying that she was being held captive in this basement. And the detectives were all kind of talking about, well, you know, maybe she's just a runaway and she's just, you know, she's in trouble. And, you know, maybe she's trying to, like, cover something up bad that she did. So because I was there, they were all just going to ignore the call. But I said, look, hey, you know, this could be real. And if it's real and you don't investigate it and this person is hurt, then, you know, this could be bad. Mm. So anyway, they decided to take it to computer division to see if they could locate her. And they did locate her, and she was being held captive.
Wow.
So my experience for a year was to listen to detectives I have so many stories where they wouldn't investigate, yeah, or they wouldn't respond to women, or they said, well, she didn't act the way we wanted her to. She wasn't respectful. So we're not going to give her any attention. So,
I'm so sorry to interrupt there, but thank you for your call and quite the story from your experience in Detroit's 6th Precinct. Barbara, I mean, go ahead and respond to Thea, but she also makes me think of, in addition, you also write about how, like, there are some places where there's training going on within law enforcement agencies when it comes to changing attitudes about victims, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah. And I thought Detroit was one of the places.
Yeah.
This story is, it's really stunning to me, and I hope she leaves her telephone number because I'd like to talk with her. There are places. I mean, let me mention a couple of things. One is there seems to be often a division between prosecutors and police. And what we've seen in a lot of cities, and Detroit is one of them, and actually Cleveland is another, mm-hmm, is that the police were more reluctant to make changes, to really thoroughly investigate these cases. It's why the Cleveland Task Force had to hire like 25 detectives out of retirement. They couldn't get them from the police department. So there's this kind of divide between the police and the prosecutors. And that was true in Detroit as well. I mean, Kim Worthy basically had to hold bake sales to get money to, not quite that bad, but she had to do fundraisers to get money to test the kits because the legislature wasn't giving her money and the police were kind of dragging their heels on it. And so there is this division. I thought it was a little bit better in Detroit. It sounds like they have a ways to go.
Yeah.
But you're right, there is training going on, and it's funded by the SAKI, the federal program, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative program. And so there is training going on, but I'll tell you, I've talked to the detectives and the researchers who work with the people, that the prosecutors and the police out in these various SAKI sites. And what they tell me is that it is really hard to change a culture. That basically, you know, they say, yeah, we believe women. But when they're having a beer with a guy after the session, they're like, you know what? I mean, we just don't believe 8 out of 10. They're just lying. And so these attitudes are really hard to change.
Yeah.
I think the Me Too movement will change things. I think we are in a different moment right now where things are going to get better, but we have a long way to go.
Well, let's get one more call here before we run out of time. Joe is calling from Yonkers, New York. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, I'm a retired New York City detective. I work in the Bronx for the last 12 years of my career. And for the most part, I lived in Westchester in a nice area, but I went to work down in the Bronx, and it was very bad, especially during the 80s, my last few years back there. I've been retired for 20 years. But now it sounds good on paper, what everyone's saying, but I actually lived on those streets every day. And it's dangerous, and the people down there, the life is cheap. They don't care. It gets a whole different thing than where I live. I, quite honestly, I don't want to sound rude, but I live in a white neighborhood in Westchester. And when I have to go to work down into the Bronx every day, I mean, it was literally, they hated the cops. They hate me. I'm a white guy. It got to the point at the end of my career, I'll be quite honest with you, and I don't want to be rude because everyone's, I'm just trying to be honest with you, that most of me and the men and women on our force, we didn't even care anymore. You just can kill each other for all we cared. And now it sounds cruel to say that, but I'm telling you the God's honest truth. I live this every day. You go to work, and these people, you don't know if you're going to get killed. And we don't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that cops get paid a lot of money. We don't. But I'm just telling you, as far as rape and murder down the Bronx, we were actually told to stand down on stuff like that. That wasn't even important. Okay? You know,
Joe, let me jump in here. You were told by whom to stand down?
We were told by our sergeant, make sure you take care of yourselves. That's the priority. These animals killed each other. They don't care about you. And this and that. And I'm telling you, God's honest verbatim what they told us.
Well, Joe, let me say thank you for your call very much. We're just running out of time, and I want to get a response to your story of your personal experience from Chief Rick Bell. So, Chief Bell, you heard Joe there saying that his experience from a couple of decades ago in New York, I think, just what's your response to what he said?
It's outrageous. I believe exactly what he's saying. You've seen it. I've seen it. You hear about it. There are some parts of the country that are more difficult to patrol than others, and it's true. And it wears down a police officer. It could wear down a department. But you talked about the necessity for training. Mm-hmm. And we have to train constantly on the neurobiology of the brain, on victim vulnerability issues, sensitivity issues towards our diverse population. Unless you have training, you'll never learn about the fight, flight, or freeze aspect. You'll never learn how victims might not seem appropriate to you as a police officer, as a prosecutor, because they all act differently. And in fairness to the police, I think police officers, if they had more resources from their administration, you know, they'd take it. They love to go to trainings. They would love to be able to learn more about how to combat crime, and they would love more resources. And they're not out there. Now, that's not an excuse. You have to fight against this every single day as a law enforcement officer, whether you're in the courtroom or whether you're out on the streets. And yes, you have to protect yourself, but you're there to serve. You're there to serve others, and that's why you take the job. It's an oath that you take, and you have to be diligent and you have to be vigilant to care for others in this job.
Well, Barbara, we've just got a minute left to go, and my last question for you is, you know, thinking of the successes in Cuyahoga County, there's so much that's been learned, right, about the propensity for a rapist to be a serial rapist, or as Chief Bell said, they commit a whole variety of crimes. It just seems as if there's a whole new chapter in what we understand about these serial offenders. What's it going to take to sort of spread that knowledge and perhaps change the way that law enforcement even approaches these crimes in the future?
Well, I think one thing is basically shows like this will help. I think the federal government giving money for training helps a lot. Kamala Harris is talking about $100 million to test rape kits. I think we are in a moment that things are beginning to change. I think there's a generational change that will be required. I think some people will have to retire and new, younger officers will have to come in and be kind of more sensitized. But I am not pessimistic about the future. I'm a little pessimistic about the present because I think there's a lot of skepticism going on right now. But I think with more information, more training, and more publicity, this gets fixed.
Well, Barbara Bradley Haggerty, we have a link to her Atlantic article at onpointradio.org. And Chief Rick Bell from Cuyahoga County, thank you both so much. This is On Point.